You are listening to Up to Me Radio, the best in inspirational talk radio. It's up to me.
Good evening, and welcome to this week's broadcast of Life's Tough, You Can Be Tougher. We had our premiere broadcast several weeks ago, and since then, we've been off and running. I'm Dustin Planholt, your host. This is a show about life and purpose. It's about the stories we all have. Everyone, when you think about it, has a story. Some stories may sound more riveting than others. That's to be expected. Not every story, after all, is the basis for a blockbuster movie. Yet when you think about your own story, the most important thing to consider is what you will do with it. Or, to put it another way, what will your legacy be? We're looking forward to another terrific show with this week's special call-in guest, Nicholas Sansbury Smith, a USA Today best-selling author of post-apocalyptic science fiction, my favorite genre. And back with us in the studio is my friend, Oren Stewart, host of The O Factor. Hello, Oren.
Hey, Dustin. How are you?
Good. Good to see you again, Oren.
Always a pleasure.
We're broadcasting, of course, from the Alston Carlisle Studio in Baltimore, Maryland. Our other special guest here in studio is Christina Knapp from Charm City Players.
Hi, hello, Christina. Dustin. Hi. How are you?
Hey. All right. Before we begin, I also want to welcome a returning sponsor, the POI Institute. POI is a private, holistic detox center located in gorgeous Cabo San Lucas, on the Baja California Peninsula. Get a safe, effective start on reclaiming your life at POI. Call the POI Institute at 833-POI-CABO. That's 833-POI-CABO. And tell them Life's Tough sent you. Nicholas Sansbury Smith, a New York Times and USA Today best-selling author of post-apocalyptic science fiction, with more than a million books sold. Nick's books have come out as parts of ongoing individual series, including Helldivers, Extinction Cycle, Trackers, and Orbs. He self-published his first book in 2013 through Amazon, when writing was just a hobby. Since then, he has had two major book deals with top five publishers, Simon & Schuster and Orbit Books, and a third with Blackstone Publishing. His fifth Helldivers book, Captives, is out this month. He's probably best known for his Extinction Cycle series, a saga that has expanded into eight books in the main storyline, and multiple spin-off stories from a dozen-plus authors in the former Kindle World program. Prior to launching his writing career, Nick worked in disaster planning and mitigation for the Iowa Homeland Security and Emergency Management Office. He assisted communities with their plans for responding to natural and man-made catastrophes. This particular field of work later inspired him to begin writing fictional narratives tied to apocalyptic events. He and his wife reside in his native town of Des Moines, Iowa, with their dogs. And with that, we'd like to welcome Nick to the show. How are you, Nick?
Great. Thanks for having me. This is something I've been looking forward to all week.
Well, same here, Nick. And you and I, you know, the odd thing for those listening in, and I know I sound like I'm a 90-year-old man, but Nick and I are both the same age. And so one of the challenges we're coming up with, what are we going to ask Nick today? And for me, the biggest struggle is he's accomplished more than me. He has written many more books. He always found time. And so with that, the question I want to ask him is, Nick, many others in their life have not put the time into what you have. How did you find time?
Well, I've really made time. There's been so many, situations where I've kind of passed up doing certain things that I would have rather have done than, you know, sitting at my desk and writing. But I've really pursued this career and treated it like a business. And I think with any entrepreneur, you have to make sacrifices. And I kind of learned how to do that a long time ago before I started writing, just with my former career. And, you know, I was working full time for the state of Iowa when I first got out of college, and then taking night classes and weekend classes for grad school.
Wow.
And also working at a sushi bar as a as a bartender.
You're kidding me. I love sushi. Where was it? Did you serve me?
Probably not. Des Moines. So I kind of just always had this drive and hustle, I guess. It was just ingrained in me. And once I started writing, it just got – the fire was ignited way more than anything else I've done before. Part of that is because I'm passionate about what I do, and I love what I do. So that frankly helps the amount of hours I put in, because normally – I don't think of this as a job. I don't think of it as work. But in the past, you know, my other jobs I did, and it was a struggle sometimes to put in so many hours to try to, you know, make a living, get my education. And so I feel really blessed where I'm at now. And part of it is, I think, through hard work, but just commitment to becoming a better writer and putting out each book that I put out, trying to make sure that the quality is better than the last, and, you know, engaging my readers. And so that's kind of a long answer to your question.
Well, it's a very honest question. So let me ask you that. It kind of leads into the next question of what's your schedule look like?
That's a good question, and one I get quite often, because, you know, here in Des Moines, Iowa, there aren't a whole lot of creative types that's at least that gets a sort of recognition for it. You tend to think that a lot of writers or people that are working in movies or whatnot are living on the West Coast or the East Coast.
Right.
And so it seems like whenever I do an event here, people are just absolutely fascinated with, you know, not only how did I create a career out of this, but what my day looks like on a daily basis. And essentially, like, I have it pretty structured, to working in the mornings on basically getting things out of the way, like emails and whatnot, and then, you know, accounting, because there's all sorts of accounting work that goes on now that I have a publishing company, paying other authors, things like that. And then I move into editing my work, because I find that my writing time is normally in the afternoon and the evening. So I'll edit, and then I'll take a break, typically exercise every day, and then in the afternoons I'll sit down and start writing my word count for the day, which is typically 2,000 words.
2,000 words. Wow.
That's pretty much the average that I usually hit. Some days I do a lot better than that, but normally I don't give up until I've hit 2,000, unless I'm having a really bad day.
That's great insight.
And then yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, it's just really a typical day for me is that structure. And then on the weekends, I try to get caught up with things that I've missed out on the weekend or on the weekdays. You know, I take a look at my Amazon ads or other ads I have running to make sure that they're running properly and I'm not burning money, and I get caught up on, some other projects, because I usually have two books going at a time. So that's really what my week looks like and my day.
Nick, how are you? This is Oren.
Hey, Oren, how's it going?
I'm doing awesome, man. Question for you, and clearly it shows that you are extremely passionate about writing. I want to ask you a question. Have you always had a passion for writing, and as well as becoming a published author?
Yeah, and I'm going to add into it, did it come easy?
Yeah. You remember that age, how old you were?
Yeah, I always, you know, I have a twin brother, and he's pretty creative too. He was always drawing pictures, and later when we got older, he was doing experimenting with different types of painting, and I was always the writer. And I knew from, you know, an early age, even when I was in high school, I thought that it'd be wonderful to turn that into a career. But then, as you know, I went to college, I took some university some courses at the University of Iowa is the Writer's Workshop program, one of the most famous ones in the world. And I took a couple classes there, and I think that's when I realized how difficult it was going to be to become a published author. And I kind of shelved that dream for almost a decade. Actually, probably it was a decade. It wasn't until I realized that I actually met a guy here in Des Moines who had had some success self-publishing. And I looked into it. I had written a book already, and I decided to go ahead and self-publish that via Amazon. And I'll tell you, it wasn't easy at all. That first book tanked, and I was pretty frustrated. I knew it wasn't the best book. I didn't have any illusions about that, but I was not sure why it wasn't selling compared to some other books in my genre. So I really took the time to research how to market on Amazon before I put my next book out. And that when that book came out, it's called Orbs, that book went viral. And essentially it was because of the marketing experience and knowledge that I gained from listening to podcasts, just social media posts from other authors that had success self-publishing. And since then, that was 6 years ago almost, and I've really treated this writing as a business, essentially. Wow. And so now I'm one of the, let's say, top marketing consultants for my genre. I do a lot of one-on-one coaching with some of the top.
That's amazing.
Yeah, well done.
Thanks. Yeah, it's fun. I mean, I actually really like the marketing aspect, so I think that helps too. And I love writing. So the combination, I think, has led to my success. And it's also helped me kind of transition with the changes that you've probably seen in publishing. You know, you have a lot of different things going on right now with traditional publishers, indie publishers, and then authors like me. I'm a hybrid author, so I do self-publishing, but I also have traditional publishers as well. And I can talk about that certainly if you guys want to. The biggest change that I've seen in publishing is just the dominance of ebooks and now audio too. Audio has become huge, and I think royalty-wise, I'm probably making just as much in audio now than anything else. So that kind of shows how that's just been a recent change in the past couple of years.
Hi, Nick. This is Christina. Hi.
Hi.
How are you? Good. I just had a question for you. Do you have any favorite authors or a mentor who's inspired you to write?
Yeah, so I'm in my office right now, so I have a pretty good view of all the books on my shelves, and I collect a lot of my favorites. I read a lot of post-apocalyptic fiction. That's the genre I write in, and it's what I love to read too. So some of my favorite authors, like indie wise, DJ Mollet, he wrote the Remaining series. I was actually just talking to him today. But he was a big inspiration for me when I first started. He had self-published on Amazon and had just massive success. And he ended up signing with David Fugate, who is now my agent as well. He's with Launch Books. And so David ended up getting DJ a pretty massive deal with Orbit Publishing for his Remaining series. And then 3 years later, Orbit came in and bought my Extinction Cycle series.
Wow. That's
great. Yeah, it was pretty.
Activity pretty creates crazy. Activity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy how it was all connected. And now DJ and I are pretty good friends. I love his books. He writes mostly post-apocalyptic fiction, but he's also done some thrillers too. His Remaining series is probably the most popular. When book six came out, it hit the New York Times bestseller list in paperback, which is pretty amazing considering the series had already been out for a while.
Yeah, what an honor.
Yeah. So I would say him, in terms of indie authors, I also, I read a lot of, I try to find stuff that isn't, like on the bestseller list, but is like a hidden gem. And one of those, probably one of my favorite books is this book called Three by Joe J. Posey. Yeah. And I highly recommend that one to anyone that likes post-apocalyptic fiction. It's very unique. And I mean, it has definitely hit the bestseller list at times, but it's one of those more, like I said, hidden gems,
And I'm going to get a copy of your top 10 or top 25, might be top 100. We're going to make sure we put it on
those hidden gems are the best.
Yeah. I want to make sure we get the word out.
Okay, awesome. And I can keep going through, but like One Second After by William Fortson.
That's fantastic. What a great series.
Yep, it is. And he's kind of, he inspired me to write my Tracker series, because that's based off an EMP apocalypse as well.
Yeah.
That's really the only thriller that I've written that doesn't have science fiction elements in it. And part of that inspiration was also my former job at Iowa Homeland Security. And I can talk about that later. But back to books. Here's another really good series by Jason Pugh. Or how, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but he wrote The Darwin Elevator, which was a New York Times bestseller. And that is a fantastic post-apocalyptic series. And it's now been expanded into 5 books. So it came out as a trilogy, was very popular, and now there's 5 in that. But I'd have to say my all-time favorite author right now he doesn't write post-apocalyptic fiction. It's Don Winslow. He writes thrillers. And his newest is called The Cartel. It's the third book in it's The Border. The second book was called The Cartel. The Border just came out. And it ends his basically 20-year project on writing about it's fiction, but it's based on the drug war and the situation going on at the border, and it's just fantastic.
It's done well. So that kind of really, as the post-apocalyptic world, I always find that always has these, I call these ethical dilemmas. So where do you think that comes from? Or do you think that that is world life? Whereas the EMP goes off and now you have to make a decision that is help myself or help others. So how do you see the genre when it comes to the dilemma part?
Well, you know, I try to treat my characters like I would envision people acting in real life. And I think there's a spectrum. So, you know, a lot of people are going to just totally freak out in an apocalyptic event, have no idea what to do. Even I would say the prepper type, a lot of those people might know what to do, but when it comes down to it, you don't know how you're going to react. And, so I try to create, you know, characters that are going to have, or multiple characters that react in different ways. And I think a little bit of my own personality comes out in some of that too. Because I always ask myself that same question, like what happens if I'm working at a coffee shop and someone comes in and fires an AR-15, or if I'm driving home and the air raid sirens go off and it's not because it's a tornado warning, like what would I do in those situations, for example? And I think that's really the fascinating thing about post-apocalyptic fiction, is people that have this question on not only how they would react, but what would happen. And, you know,
it's fascinating. You always think of, how do you know you would react unless you're in the situation? Like, well, maybe you would do something different.
Yeah. And also, there's this weird kind of morbid fascination with post-apocalyptic fiction, I think, because our way of life would be completely eradicated. So you wouldn't have any of the luxuries we have. Even down to little things like taking a warm shower or sleeping in a clean bed, or, you know, having a cell phone and checking your text messages, whatever.
Or keeping your insulin at the right room temperature.
Absolutely.
I mean, things like that, you know, we look at, most of the places that people are at to keep themselves alive, all of a sudden the lights turn off, the electricity goes out, and the backups, well, they fail eventually. The world will be a much different place. So that leads into, Chrissy has another question for you.
So I produce plays and musicals based off of other authors' works. So how do you go about creating the worlds that become the backdrops for your stories and novels?
That's a really good question. I typically have an idea in my mind that sometimes it ends up becoming a book, but oftentimes I just write them down and kind of experiment with what they might look like as a story. But I also kind of do a little bit of writing to market, because since this is a career and it is a business, trying to make sure whatever story I'm putting out is something that readers will pick up. And my Helldivers series, for example, is probably the most, in my opinion, diverse and unique world that I've created. And I wasn't sure it was going to work just because it was so isolated to the sky. Basically, in Helldivers, humanity resides on two airships after a post-apocalyptic event. It's 250 years in the future after this post-apocalyptic event. So there were multiple airships in the beginning housing the final bastions of humanity, and they all, almost all of them, came crashing back down to the Earth over time. And Earth is poisoned, so that's why they can't set down. There's electrical storms blocking out the sun pretty much everywhere.
Well, all things planet. That we would both agree that are potentially possible if all of the right elements come together.
Right. I mean, that this is probably the most terrifying future that I can envision, and it became a series. But it really started off with just an idea. And that idea wasn't even in the sky at first. It was exploring survivors living in bunkers. But at that time, there were so many books already about that concept.
Yeah, was that Wool, if I remember correctly?
Yep, I'm looking right at it this instant. And there's a ton of books actually that kind of spun off in that direction. So I thought, why not try something different? I knew there had been books about airships, but I decided to create these bunkers basically in the sky. And the Helldivers are men and women that come from all walks of life. Some of them are former engineers or militia soldiers or mechanics. There's some thieves that were conscripted into duty. And basically their job is to jump through these apocalyptic storms to the surface and scavenge for parts to keep the airships in the sky, and along the way look for, you know, other things that they need. And the airships have their own economies and their own, you know, they produce, they have their own, they have a farm, they have a water treatment plant, all things that you would need to survive. So I really just kept expanding on this idea and trying to visualize like what it would actually look like and how it would work. So it was, I'm just giving that as one example.
That's a great backdrop.
Nick, I'll tell you, this is Oren again. That's a great backdrop. I'll tell you, man, you almost had me closing my eyes and envisioning the story as you're saying.
We were right there. Back.
We were right there with you, man. Question for you. Awesome. And actually, this is a great segue. What draws your readers in? You know, it sounds like you write from a reader standpoint, actually, even more than just a writer.
How do we think, by the way? Am I that messed up that I want to read about the end of the world?
Exactly, right?
So, tell me, I'm not the only one.
Yeah. So what do you think draws us in?
It kind of depends. When I'm thinking about post-apocalyptic readers, they want to experience an apocalypse that is engaging with action and characters that seem realistic. I think that's a huge part of it. I also noticed that a lot of these post-apocalyptic stories that are hugely popular have humor elements in them. And that's one
which
thing
is always
actually,
great.
It is. And that's something that I've actually struggled with as a writer, because it's hard to know when to insert humor in a book that's really bleak. And I remember the first manuscript for my Extinction Cycle that I submitted to my agent. He came back with a ton of comments, as he always does. And one of them was, dude, you have these characters smiling way too much. And I was thinking, well, yeah, I mean, they're still going to find moments of joy.
Yeah.
But then I realized, like, yeah, there's people aren't going to be joking around or laughing, smiling like, and, you know, even in real life, that doesn't always happen. So there are definitely characters that I think other authors have created that are just humorous in themselves, and that works really well.
Yeah.
I've created some of those myself, but creating like a humorous apocalypse is something that I've never really been able to do, but there's definitely that side of the genre.
Gotcha.
There's a lot of readers that like that. I write books that are more bleak and, you know, honestly depressing in some ways.
More like real life.
Yeah. And because I'm trying to make the most realistic apocalypse.
Indeed.
And, and that's what I did with Helldivers. And, you know, the reviews are pretty good on those books. But the ones that I've seen that are negative, not all of them are like this, but a lot of them are talking about how depressing that is. And you know, it, that's what I designed it to be. But I can totally understand why people don't want to read that sort of thing, too, when life can be depressing in itself. So for me, when I'm writing an apocalyptic novel, the way I try to engage readers is kind of a format that includes a compelling world that is unique. For each of my books I've tried, or each of my series, I've tried to create a unique world. So for Helldivers, I've already described that. But with Orbs, I wanted to do a unique or something that's never been done for an alien invasion. And that's essentially what an orb is.
So let me ask you that, Nick. Do you believe we're the only ones out there? Absolutely. He was waiting, I want you to go on record.
He was waiting to ask
tell me
you
what
that
the
question.
Man thinks. What does Nick think about aliens?
I was actually just talking about this last night because I was trying to explain how I thought. If there are aliens on Earth, they're probably an octopus because they have the most alien DNA out of any creature.
Very true.
But I don't think those are like little green men. I'm just talking about their DNA.
I absolutely believe
that there's life on other planets and that life potentially has already visited us. I have some kind of weird theories about all that.
Now you can dig into it a little bit. So tell me, have you ever had that one moment you say, hey, Dustin, I'm telling you, it doesn't make sense. So which means it probably happened. Like, is there been something that made you think a little differently on things? Like, let's say enlighten you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I actually had a kind of a weird moment the other night. I was driving home from the coffee shop at like 9:30 and I was pretty much already having an adrenaline rush from all the coffee I'd consumed throughout the day. And I just started thinking about like life and how it starts, how much of a miracle it is to even get where we are, to be born. I mean, you have to win the race. And
very true.
You know, just how amazing it's like winning the lottery, but also having that opportunity to even have a ticket.
Wow.
So I started thinking about that. And then I'm like, and then I just kept going on and on. And it was just one of those weird moments that I had about the universe and how life came to be, but then where did life start originally?
That's right.
Pretty much the type of questions that humans have always asked, but we're not able to fathom the answers to those types of questions.
We had this. We got into this last week, being the same age as you, Nick. I same thing. Kind of the place to say, okay, so if we go to bedrock on every story, including Adam and Eve, like, well, what was the bedrock of their story? And well, whatever the origin is of anything, outer space, any. What do we look at it from a scientific standpoint? And you can still blend faith if that's what you want to lean on in the end. But you're right. It is you're like me. It's to take things at face value was just indoctrination. It's where you're born is what you're going to believe. And that's one of the things that I can tell you that as a reader, that you have this way of bringing me in and allowing me to make my own decisions that you don't indoctrinate. I look at, you know, one of the characters in the Extinction series, you know, obviously Reed and Fitz, like, the character fits for me is this was a person saying, I want in the club. I'll do anything. You have Reed that loses a body part and says, I'm not quitting. I'm not giving up. And yet all of them believe they have a purpose. So what is your purpose? What would you say that at the end of your life or the end of your day, you were to be defined as what? And I will tell you again what I think of you as you leave me on the reading side of it. What would you say your purpose is?
You know, I'm not really sure because I'm not sure I have just one purpose or that I was, you know, there's a lot of things that I've pursued in my life so far and a lot of things that I enjoy doing. If I could say there's one purpose, it might be to be a storyteller. But that could also change eventually to be a parent or something like that. I think that for most people, your purpose, can change throughout your life and it depends on circumstances.
Well,
so I don't want to really say that I was put here to write books because I mean, I try to also be humble about my work too, because you know, I network a lot. I see a lot of authors. I already kind of talked to you about how I feel about sharing like sales data and whatnot, but it's one of those things where like I write because I love doing it and I want to share stories. And when you're talking about like preaching or indoctrinating readers. That's one thing that I never will do. I make it a point not to even put politics in my book, because for me, sharing a story is supposed to be entertaining. At the same time, I'm trying to teach people stuff too, like survival tips and whatnot for the apocalypse. But I'm always trying to have diverse characters too. So in my books, you'll see people that have different, that come from all different types of or walks of life, that have, that are, you know, have different religions. And that was really big for me in the Extinction Cycle, because it's something you have to be pretty careful of in the genre I write in, to not try to swing things a certain way. Cause that actually can alienate readers, which I'm sure you probably read books like
that. I have been many times going, well, I don't believe the same as you. And well, therefore, if I don't think I can continue. And I think that's the challenge all of us face. So talking about writing and talking about a book, my book, Life's Tough, You Can Be Tougher, is coming out on June the 30th. One of the challenges that anybody faces in this space is when you are an unknown writer and you are trying to find a way to write so for your reader, not the way you want, but at the same time, making sure you put in only truth. One of the things I found with you is your ability to dig into a story and not embellish it. Like you found a way to find facts in the military, in the environment. And so that really leads us into our next question, and one I'm going to throw back to Chrissy from Charm City Players.
Is there such a thing as taking a story too far with its fantasy elements? Sorry.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's something I see in negative reviews sometimes, too, for Helldivers specifically, because some people can't suspend their disbelief for that type of situation. And I think, you know, even in the Game of Thrones episode on Sunday.
Fantastic show. That was insane, man.
Yeah, definitely. But even in a fantasy world like that, sometimes there's certain things that you can't do without the reader saying, or the audience rather, thinking like, this is not possible. So let's just take zombies, for example. Like the reason that I decided to add realistic science into my Extinction Cycle series is because I wanted to create an event where a human could become a zombie-like creature. So I explained that through what's called epigenetic changes. They basically turn on genes that have been turned off and create the perfect predator. And
yeah, that for me it's an ancient code in your system. It's been there all along.
Right. Yeah. So that's why I did that, because I wanted readers to not have to suspend disbelief, and some still probably weren't able to, but at least I presented, I think, a scientific explanation for how these very sick humans became what I called variants. And it's science fiction is definitely different than fantasy. I think you can get away with a lot more in fantasy than you can in science fiction. And I learned the hard way, because my first series, Orbs, did not have hard science fiction in it. In fact, it was more what I'd call B-rated science fiction, if that. And that really caused me to realize that if you don't have realistic science in your books and people want hard science fiction, that's going to cause a major problem. So, you know, talking about your book, Dustin, and what you have to figure out, I mean, you're in a totally different space than I am.
Correct.
But you have to present your story in a way that readers buy it, essentially. And so I guess that's a long answer, but yes, absolutely, I think you can go too far in fantasy and science fiction.
Yeah, so let me ask you, in terms of your books, and would you consider it to be PG, PG-13, and would you ever be willing to do R?
I mean, I think that my books are probably already around the R rating. I've specifically told my mother not to read them.
Did she read it anyway?
No, she started one, but the other thing, I've even been really careful. My twin brother, he has a business called Man Up, which is teaching at-risk youth to be men, essentially. And
sounds like a great organization.
I've gone to mentor those kids and talk to those kids on numerous occasions, and I've handed out my books, but I'm very careful about making sure that there are at least 14 because my books do have elements in them that I don't think are appropriate for youth. So I would probably rate it at, closer to R almost. So maybe not even appropriate for 14 years old. I've kind of let my brother determine that because he knows the kids better than I do.
Oh, that's pretty interesting. Great. So that leads us to the next question.
Next question for you. How do you know when you've completed a particular series of books? And that's Oren again.
Like, when do you know? I've told the story. Exactly. Like, I'm comfortable with it.
Because I've always wondered, you know, when you're writing, and I write as well, when do you feel like you've come to the closing of a book and it's time to put it down and start another one? Or either you want to stretch it out and make it more like the series that you do?
That's such a good question. And sometimes I don't know the answer to that. For me, it's kind of been on an individual basis.
Gotcha.
And it also can kind of be, you know, there's other elements involved, though. For me, since this is how I put food on the table, sometimes it's a financial decision and or a publishing contract issue. So for like Orbs, for example, I always wanted to write a book for and kind of end the series the way I wanted to. But that series was bought by Simon & Schuster back in 2014.
Wow.
So up until 2018, they had the rights to that, and I didn't want to do a fourth book. I don't think they would have wanted to anyways. I mean, it wasn't even discussed, honestly.
Yeah.
So I eventually got the rights back in 2018, and I put out a book four, and I self-published books one through three again.
Wow.
And that's just an example of a contract issue where I could have maybe self-published book four, but I wanted to make sure I had all the books, the rights to all the books before I did that, so I could kind of control the destiny of how those were published again. The Tracker series was always meant to be a trilogy. Book three just ended up being so long that I decided to add a fourth to that, and I'm very happy with the way that ended. That's one I get questions on even daily still. Are there going to be more books? But I'm pretty happy with the way that storyline tied up. So that one is just kind of natural. But yeah, for Helldivers, that was signed as a trilogy with Blackstone. And I just, you know, there's so much more story to tell in that one. And the sales were just so fantastic, especially in the audio, that
so you had to write another one.
Yeah. They said, let's do a book four and a five. And then they said, okay, how about a book six and a seven? And I mean, I could keep going. I absolutely love the storyline too. And that's another thing that I think is very important. If you're continuing a storyline, you need to be absolutely in love with it.
That's true.
Or at least enjoy writing it. Because if you're burned out, the reader is going to be able to tell. And so that's kind of what happened in my Extinction Cycle. Mm-hmm. That one kept going and going. And I love the characters. But I felt like I needed to take a break from it. Go ahead.
No. I wanted you to keep going, because actually a thought that I had when you were talking, have you ever felt like you had to force a story out of you in regards to contract purposes? You know, like feel like it's another one that's expected of you and you're like, I'm done. I want to close this one off. But you kind of feel like I have to pull it out of, you know, find a place to write it. Have you ever had
I'm fortunate that I've never felt that way.
That's good to know.
I think that some writers do, and especially with traditional publishers. But for me, I have never really experienced a story that I felt like I had to write.
That's great, man.
It does feel good to end a contract, though, to know that you can move on to the next thing. But And I'm thinking, just because I have a 7-book contract right now with Blackstone,
okay,
and with a short story or a novella as well. And I'm almost at the end of that. And that's been a couple of years in the making, or, you know, just writing those books. And so I am looking forward to being to moving on to something else, whether it's with them or, you know, another publisher or self-publishing. So that's really the only thing I can relate to in terms of a country. Contractual issues, yeah. But in terms of storyline, I've never pumped anything out just to pump it out.
Yeah, that's good to know.
readers would be able to tell. I mean, I did leave book four of my Helldivers series with a major cliffhanger, just because I felt like that was what needed to happen.
That was the way to end it.
Say a to be continued.
Keep everybody guessing.
Yes, but it's always like a Great story.
Some people aren't cool with that. And I'm, you know, so I got some flack on that, but it was definitely not a money grab. And that's one thing writers face a lot too. I think that when you expand a universe and you keep writing in it, there's going to be that small portion percent of readers that think that you're just doing it for the money. But, and I was actually talking to a blogger about this yesterday because, and he told me his opinion on it. He said that you can totally tell as a reader. And you know what? As a reader, I can as well. So yeah,
there's some that have become so commercialized, some of the top authors out there in the fiction space where, you know, it's not them writing it. It's 18 people behind them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can feel it.
Yeah.
So Nick, I'm going to jump in. I have a question for you. Since I'm I'm with Charm City Players, we're Maryland, D.C., and Northern Virginia's best family theater, and we get all kinds of messages all the time after families see our shows, how inspired they are. My question for you is, what kind of messages do you get from your followers and your readers?
Oh, I get a variety. Some are absolutely crazy.
Tell us about that. What would be like the craziest question you got? You say, man, this is the one I framed.
Well, some questions don't even make sense, or some messages don't make sense. And I'm not sure why, but I think social media has, for me, I'm so active on social media and I'm so accessible that I probably get more comments and just emails and Facebook messages from readers than a lot of other authors. And I also respond to them. I know a lot of authors that don't do that. And part of the reason is what we're talking about right now, because there isn't as much distance between readers and authors as there used to be.
Right.
And I've kind of built my brand on being accessible and having a positive brand and saying, go ahead, please contact me. I'd love to hear your thoughts. So I'm trying to think of most of the time I'm like lately, for example, just yesterday, I got a few questions about my Helldivers series and certain, things about that world and just questions about the plot. So I get a lot of plot questions. And then I get a lot of questions about expanding books or reading order since I have series, and then events, of course. But I'm trying to think if I can share a crazy one for you guys that is.
Yeah, I'm waiting for it. Hopefully it didn't come from
maybe
me.
Maybe I need to think about it. I'll just share some of the, I get some emails from readers that think I'm one of those con man type writers.
Think you're a fraud?
Yeah, they think I'm trying to pull something over on them because it always has to do with pricing, because my books are on Amazon, of course, and Amazon, the pricing changes frequently. And for the Helldiver series, especially, those books, they're not specific. They're not exclusive to Amazon like my self-published books are. So those prices change. Like if a price goes down on another site, then Amazon price matches. So I've just had some crazy emails accusing me of trying to rip people off. And
it's a shame.
Like another thing, Amazon offers a discount if you buy the Kindle version. They offered a discount on the audio version if you buy the Kindle version first on almost all books. And for whatever reason, a couple weeks ago, I started getting these messages about Helldivers 4 because that wasn't an option for Helldivers 4. And these people were thinking that it was my fault, that I was trying to make more money. And I reached out to the publisher and they contact Audible, and Audible hadn't turned it on yet. It just was a mechanism that they hadn't turned on for whatever reason. So those are the kind of the things that I struggle with in terms of how to reply, because I'm not trying to, like, I already try to convince my publishers to lower the prices on my books. I've had battles between me and my agent and publishers to try to get my prices down to what I think is reasonable. And for me, that's like the $4.99. For Kindle version, digital version, I don't really like to see my books at more than $5. And that is not something that my publishers agree with. They want to sell for more. And I understand there's a lot more overhead, but for my self-published books, the highest price I've ever had was $4.99. Most of my self-published books are $2.99.
I call it, you're a man of the people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very noble of you.
Well, I think you have to treat your readers well too, though, or
They're your audience.
They're your ambassadors.
Yeah, they're your audience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's one thing I've kind of been known for, is treating my readers well, not just for prices and stuff like this or engaging them, but I do a lot of, I do so many giveaways, and I pretty much give away, I have patches for all my series. So for each book that comes out, I have a new patch made, and I have a spreadsheet of over 6,000 people I've sent stuff to in the past 5 years.
That's cool, man. So I'm surprised I'm not on that list. I got to find a way. Who do I contact?
Well, there's a comment or in the back of all my books, it says contact me if you'd like a patch or whatever. And I also post that stuff on Facebook.
Well, I'm putting it on record, Nick. I want a patch.
Yes, indeed.
There's a patch with your name on. I'll send you guys a bunch of patches.
Oh, please do. We're gonna have those with pride.
They've become so popular that some of the patches are actually out of stock. I just got a new stock today, a new stockpile of Extinction Cycle patches.
That must be fun.
And that's just something that I enjoy doing. It's something that a reader can hold in their hand or put on their backpack or stitch into their stocking cap or whatever. And it's also good marketing, honestly, because people ask them, well, what does that represent? And then they'll talk about my book series. So it's a cool thing to do, a fun thing to do. Yeah. And it also, I think, spreads the word.
Yeah. So we had a guest on here recently, Marine Recon Sergeant Rudy Reyes. And so writing the Extinction series, you had to get to know the military, at least the characters and what they're capable of and what they're not. What did you learn about the military through this process?
I learned quite a bit. And when I was working at Iowa Homeland Security and Emergency Management, I was pretty much working with all National Guard soldiers and also retired Marines. And one of my best friends was a retired recon Marine. So
like Rudy.
He really, really helped me with the beginning drafts of the Extinction Cycle. The quote in the book that Fitz always uses, or the motto rather, that's all it takes is all you got, that came from him. And that was something they said in the Marines.
By the way, I have lifted that from you, man. I have used that ever since you wrote it. I have used it all around the world.
Wow.
A lot of people have. Yeah.
Thanks for letting me.
I get that a lot. Don't thank me. That's a Marine. That's actually a motto that the Marines use. And it's an amazing motto that's very motivational. I get emails from readers they'll sign it. All it takes is all you got.
That's fantastic. Nobody ever told me before you told me that was the motto. And we had Colonel Godfather Ferrando that called in for Rudy's show as well. And same thing there, that the mentality is all it will ever take is everything you're willing to give.
So true.
If you give everything you have, you can write. How many books have you now written, Nick?
Published books. I think I'm at 22.
Ooh, but all it takes is all you got.
That is amazing.
I have three more in the pipeline right now.
That's fantastic.
Various phases of publishing. So, yeah, but I think that working with the soldiers and Marines helped. I did a lot of research. I do research for all my books, obviously. So that, I think it was a combination of things. And I love military science fiction. The other thing that helped was my editor is a vet. And so he can really catch some
great
things
insight.
But still, I mean, I still miss things. I had a Marine email me a couple weeks ago that said he loves Extinction Cycle. It's mostly realistic.
Mostly. Got you mostly there, huh? You did an okay job.
So he gave you the thumbs up, right?
Yeah. So that's another thing about I do get a lot of these emails and comments from readers like, oh, I loved this, but here's what you messed up on. And I actually appreciate those because it helps me not make the mistake of the future.
I was going to ask you that. Do you embrace that? That critique.
Absolutely. I mean, that it's really saved me probably from future criticism, because if I fix something, then, or if I learn something, then I'm not going to make that mistake a second time.
It clearly shows you have an amazing discipline when, you know, as you're talking. I'll tell you something, man, I go back to thinking about something we wanted to ask you earlier in the show about being an athlete. An Ironman. You know, tell us a little bit about that. I know it's a little turning the corner there, but you got to tell us where all of the energy comes from and the ability to stay so focused.
Yeah, how do you hyper-focus?
Yeah, how do you do it?
That's a good question, too. So, you know, I'll go back to – I've always kind of been an athlete. I always did sports. But in 2008, I had this Hold on a second. Sorry. Yeah, I just had a weird thing happen. You guys can still hear me, right?
Yeah, can hear you fine.
Hear you fine.
Okay, sorry. Sorry about that. So
you're good.
Back in 2008, I had I got a virus in my heart called pericarditis. It affects the sac, the pericardium of the heart. It's basically I just got strep throat or something like, they weren't sure what it was, but it was a virus, and then it caused that's what they thought I had. It wasn't strep throat.
Oh my gosh. Wow, man.
But it got in my heart, and I started having really bad chest pain. It got worse and worse, and then one night I woke up at like 2 a.m, and I'm hyperventilating. I feel like I'm having a heart attack, or what I thought would be a heart attack. So my dad rushed me to the ER, and they thought I was having a heart attack, and they started asking me all these questions like, did you do meth or coke or all these crazy things. I'm like, no, dude, I was sleeping, and I've been really sick. So they did surgery on me, and they still didn't know what was going on. I was in the ICU for 2 days before. Jeez. I think they told my parents that I had pericarditis, which is deadly at times.
Oh, man.
But that was when I was working for the state in grad school and just super busy. So I worked myself probably to sickness, and then it got worse. I was going to work while I had like 103 temperature, which was my fault, but that's was the result.
You were fighting through
and,
it. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, that took me a long time to recover from. My heart had major damage to it. And I think after that, I realized, like, holy crap, like, I almost died. And I wanted to get healthy again. So I started running and doing everything I used to do to get healthy. And when I worked for Homeland Security, a couple of my friends were triathletes. So I started doing triathlons. And then they said, well, hey, we're going to try to do an Ironman. And I didn't even know what an Ironman was back then. I looked it up.
Isn't that superhero?
Like,
did you see the Avengers yet? I took my my son.
I have not seen that yet. I wanted to, but it was sold out. So I don't know if the race is actually named after the superhero, but I could see why if it was.
Yeah, the guy go. Look, you got to be tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a 2.4 mile swim. It's a 112 mile bike, and then a full marathon at the end of it. So I started training. It took me 6 months to train for. I did a half Ironman in Galveston, Texas, and then I did a full Ironman in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And that, I swear, was the reason I have the discipline I have now and the energy I have now, because it taught me how to kind of not only focus on
persevere
and through the worst pain of my life, because I also got in a super bad bike accident about a month before the full Ironman, and the doctor told me, like, there's no way you're going to be able to do this. And I was so determined that my run time, it didn't hurt when I biked for some reason, but when I ran, it was really bad pain. So my run time was way off of what I wanted to be, but I did finish. And I think that pushing through that was really taught me how to persevere and just focus on past the pain and just what your goals and accomplishing goals.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's, so you gave it all you got.
All it takes is all you have. Yeah. So last question for you, Nick, who would you say, or who is the toughest person in your life? Who pushes you? It can be the toughest man or woman. It could be a couple people. Who are the toughest people in your life?
I would say my grandpa Jake was the toughest for sure. Jake. Angelo was his real name. Angelo Jake Angren. He was an Italian immigrant. He came over here, worked in the coal mines in Waukee, Iowa, so the Schuler mining camp. He dropped out of eighth grade to work in the mines with his dad. He got shipped off to World War II, fought on Normandy Beach, Battle of the Bulge. I mean, he was just an amazing guy. Then he came home and he started working as a home builder for a company, and eventually went off on his own, built a ton of houses that are now out in Waukee. And he had a really, really tough life, and he ended up getting Alzheimer's. And seeing him fighting that disease was just probably one of the most I don't even know how to describe it, because at first he lost the ability to walk. And so he, like, I would go over there and he was in a wheelchair raking his leaves in his driveway, because he always was working. He was just such a hard worker. I mean, grew up in the Great Depression era, and, you know, just an insane work ethic. And all of his family was, he had two brothers and three sisters, and they were all like that. So just seeing him struggle and fight that disease, it wasn't even Alzheimer's that ended up. He passed away from getting a super bug that antibiotics couldn't treat. And so just seeing him go through all that, he lasted almost 10 years, I think it was, with that disease before he finally succumbed to it. So I would say by far my grandpa was the strongest, toughest guy I've ever met. And I often think about what he would think of me as a man now, because he passed away when I was 21. So I wasn't, I hadn't really experienced life like I have. I hadn't accomplished things and was still in school, basically. So I think about him often and what he would think.
It sounds like he has left quite the legacy and impression. You know, typically we always say that life's tough, but so-and-so is tougher. In this case, life's tough, but Nicholas's grandpa Jake is tougher.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, you have given us you've given us a lot to take in, the audience, and then also for me personally, as being somebody that is, well, many people claim to be your biggest fan. I go, I'm kind of your biggest fan.
Well, that's cool.
I've looked up to you for a very long time, and it's been an honor to have you on the show, and hopefully you'll come back for the next one you and I have together here soon.
Yes, absolutely. Indeed. It's been an honor being on this show, and I've had a really good time, honestly, like being able to talk about all these different things and talk about writing. And it's just, as you guys can probably tell, I love what I do.
Yes, you do, man.
And you're good at it. You haven't become a jerk yet. If you ever become a jerk, Nick, can I say, hey, jerk?
We have to play this one back.
Jerk, I need to, sit you aside and say, the last book, you didn't do it.
We have to play this interview back for you.
That's funny. I just like to share one more thing.
Go for it.
I heard from a reader the other day. I was sending him out some signed copies, and he goes, dude, Nick, I just want to tell you that it's so crazy, because he's known me from the beginning. Like, he was one of my first readers, and he's like, you have not changed a bit. You're still the same person.
Yeah.
And that's cool. I really appreciated hearing that, because I have a lot of author friends or just friends that this career has changed them. Some
of course it has.
In a positive way, but other, sure. I've seen a lot of authors too that have literally stopped writing and moved on to other things, not because they couldn't make it, but just because this is a tough career. Just like any entrepreneur, I mean,
sure.
Like I said from the beginning, you have to treat it as a business, but I think that you have to be good to whoever and whatever you do in life, you have to be good to people.
So true.
Otherwise, you're just not going to succeed.
Well said, Nick. Well, look, again, that's thank you point. for coming on, and thank you for talking to the Life's Tough community.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
We appreciate it, man.
Yeah, man, this is great. Well, yeah. You can stay on the line, or you can drop off. We're going to be kind of digging into talking about you and saying, hey, he was a nice guy, wasn't he? That guy was pretty cool.
This was a great interview, man.
Okay, thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. So I'll probably let you do your own thing, and I'll listen to it when it comes out.
Sounds good. Appreciate it, man.
All right.
Have a great rest of your week.
All right. Yeah, take care. Thanks, guys.
Bye. Man, that was fun.
Wow. That was awesome.
Well, what a cool guy.
He was, yes, like indeed.
All right.
You can definitely tell he's passionate about what he does.
He loves what he does.
Yes. Yeah. And that's it, man. That's everything.
I think that
you need
in
to be.
Life, when you find, as he said, either purpose or purposes,
is
that there may be one thing you do really well and you do something else really well, or at least comes easy. So with that, we've been talking with Nicholas Sansbury Smith, a prolific and popular writer of post-apocalyptic or science fiction. Nick's books have always held a fascination for me, as you've just heard. A disaster or calamity of epic proportions would overwhelm the world, and the survivors who remain will have to find a way to exist in their new hostile environments. How many of us have faced trials? How many of us have been in a place in our life where there was a catastrophe? And yet, it is easy to say what you will do, but what happens when you're in it? Do you change who you are? Do you become the person you've always been? This type of sci-fi resonates with me deeply on a few levels. First, while growing up in an evangelical Christian household, my sister Tennille and I often watched videos about the rapture with my mother and pastor's stepfather.
Well, the rapture refers to a time when the true believers in Jesus Christ will be summoned upward, snatched away, to meet Christ somewhere along the path to heaven. A giant horn will sound, signaling the moment when God begins this process. The people who would ascend would suddenly disappear. I know this because the videos about the rapture that our family watched would show a flash of light, and then only clothes would remain where people had been moments before. It sounds a lot like science fiction. Many of the stories that Nick says or Nick tells will others claim to be science fiction. It was as if, however, in this story in the rapture, that the people were literally sucked out of their clothes. Sometimes the videos would show a van careening through a neighborhood. People in the van would jump out and ask bystanders along the street if they believed in Jesus Christ. Those that said they did believe would be immediately murdered right on the spot so that they could enter heaven. We talked a little bit earlier about indoctrination, about the things we tell children. These are the stories that people around the world are telling children. Yet when people hear about a post-apocalyptic science fiction author, they say that that stuff's crazy. That's the things of the mind. That's the things of, well, fiction. And for those who did not believe, well, the videos didn't actually show the murders taking place, but they did show the bodies dropping. And the people who followed false gods, they had to accept the mark of the beast, 666, either on their foreheads or their right wrist. These unfortunates were the ones who were left behind. You certainly don't want to be left behind, my family would say, because there would be hell on earth. It's there written in the book of Revelation. Everyone will have to decide to either die for the sake of Jesus or accept the mark of the beast and face inevitable doom and what would be a world of fire, destruction, and devastation. Apocalyptic. This would be the start of the end times. For certain groups of Christians, like my family, it was essential to be prepared for the rapture. The only way, of course, was to commit to Christ. Dustin, you need to tell people that they've got to turn to the Lord Jesus Christ, or they will be left behind, she'd say. He's only taking those who believe in him. When we hear these words, and people like me that read these books by Nicholas Sansbury Smith and other authors like it, the thought of being left behind, being prepared, well, as you hear these stories around the world of this rapture, well, the people have to make plans in their head because there are those who believe they will be left behind. And for those of us that believe we go up, well, maybe we don't. And, well, there's always the possibility. Well, Tennille and I, we were filled with fear after watching a series of these videos at our home and hearing our family's pronouncements. We were facing the prospect of being left behind again, as you heard in earlier stories. And that was a whole other level, which Tennille and I took to heart. We had actual experience with being left behind. Our mother had left us behind when she headed to the East Coast to start her new life. Robbie, our father, left us on a more intermittent basis when he drove off from our shack in Rainbow, California. We didn't know if he'd return in an hour, several hours, or even the next day. We had been left throughout our early childhood. The prospect of it happening again was real, too real. And our mother's focus on the rapture underscored the possibility. When we hear a story like that, and I look back to the books that I read and the things that fascinate me, the thought of being left behind, well, it just brings back childhood memories. What attracts us to science fiction? What attracts you to the books that you read? What happened along your path and your journey that made you pick up that novel, that when you were flipping through Amazon, that story, that one story about a ship, two ships, 250 years in the future, high up far enough that nothing could hurt them. Well, what happens in life is that you're never untouchable. You go to space, well, there's also problems there. These dilemmas that we face, even we think we've gotten out of the problem, a new one exists. It's been a fantastic day. For me, to talk to Nicholas has been, for me, a bit of a dream. Getting to be able to dive into the world of science fiction with him, for me, is something that I've looked forward to for years. To be able to ask somebody, I'm not the only one. You wrote this for me. Why? Many of the books you read in your own library, someone wrote it for you. That they were thinking of you. Ask yourself, am I really alone? Is there somebody else out there that thinks like me? that finds the same things that I find fascinating. Many of us are lonely. Well, when it comes to books and when it comes to clubs like it, join a club. Get together with people in your circle. Find people that are fascinated with the things that you're fascinated about. Because I can promise you that while post-apocalyptic might not be for you, it is for some people like me.
Good point.
So that wraps up our show for this evening. And I'd like to thank again our special guest, Nicholas Sansbury Smith, for sharing his insight into this ever-expanding collection of published works and for talking about the approach to writing those stories. Also, thank you, Oren, for being a part of this show.
Anytime, Dustin. Thank you.
And thank you, our amazing audience, for making the Life's Tough podcast one of the most relevant and fast-growing shows around. I'd also like to thank my dear friend, Christina Knapp. She's amazing.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Charm City.
Thank you.
You guys, you inspire a tremendous amount of people.
Very true.
You bring a lot of joy into my kids' lives.
Very true.
And a special thanks to my dear friend, Gerald Levin, Life's Tough, Cheap Writer, and my Sherpa. Also like to thank an audience today, Marcus, and our producer, John Miller. The stories we all hear are as varied as the people who tell them. And each time I hear someone's personal account, I do not frame it as something that was more horrible than my own story, or something that was not as bad as what I went through. It's impossible to discount the impact of any one singular experience. To the person who lived it, that story is just as devastating as any other. I ask you, use your story. There's power in it. Everyone has a story. Your story may be just what it takes to keep somebody from going over that edge. That maybe that day for you to go out on a run was to stop somebody from doing something wrong. Maybe your purpose is to see the signs. Maybe there was a reason that the thought came into your head. I need to go out today. I need to go to the store. I need to go call a friend. I need to text somebody. Because what if this world that Nicholas says is fiction? What if parts of it can become reality? What if we are all connected? What if there's an energy around us? And what if these thoughts and these moments that hit you were there for you to find your purpose? Remember, please subscribe to our show. Visit lifestough.com, L-I-F-E-S, tough, T-O-U-G-H.com. And be sure to join us every week, same place, for a stimulating hour of heartfelt discussion. Remember, everyone has a story. Life's tough. You can be tougher. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Next week, we'll broadcast a lively conversation with Dr. Craig, a police forensic psychologist. Tune in and we'll find out together what's involved with a job like that. Remember again, also, May is National Foster Care Month. So for Oren Stewart and the entire Life's Tough team, including Miss Christina Knapp, this is Dustin Plantholt.
Oren Stewart.
Christina Knapp.
Remember, life's tough, but Nicholas's grandfather is much tougher. Thanks again, everybody. Join us next week, same time.
Is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.